like in my behaviors. When I'm on my work branch, I turn one color. When I'm at home, I'm another color. When I'm with one set of colleagues, I accent one hue and I turn on a completely different hue with a different set of colleagues. I can work myself into believing that I'm everything from slightly disingenuous to downright cheesy. However, looking at those same behaviors from a strengths perspective, I could completely reframe my experiences. Rather than feeling inauthentic and chameleon-like, I can honestly say that I'm comfortable around many different people, in many different settings, and that I'm pretty comfortable discussing topics that range from economics to the latest Nick Jr. lineup on TV. I don't contradict myself, although I will avoid some subjects with some groups. I am often overwhelmed by how many different roles I play, and how quickly I'm expected to switch gears. However, I think I do it pretty well, and I would consider it a strength. I can go through almost every one of my faults or limitations and find strengths. The purpose of doing this is not to dismiss the issues we'd like to change or invalidate our problems, but to allow us to work on those from a place of self-worth, empathy, and connection. I think one of the most important things I learned from this research, and one of the key messages I hope I'm sending in this book, is this. We cannot change and grow when we are in shame, and we can't use shame to change ourselves or others. I can shame myself for being too controlling and uptight about my work, or I can recognize that I'm very responsible, dependable, and committed to quality work. The issues at work don't go away, but from a strengths perspective, I have the confidence to look at myself and assess the issues I'd like to change. It is important to understand that the strengths perspective is not a tool to simply allow us to put a positive spin on a problem and consider it solved, but rather to allow us to inventory our strengths so that we can use them to address the challenges. I can shame myself for being too worried about my daughter all the time, or I can reframe that, using my strengths and focus on the fact that I'm trying to be a good parent, and I'm a very thoughtful, involved, and conscientious mother. From a place of self-worth, it is easier for me to think about how I might be a better mom if I reality check some of my fears and recognize that I'm doing plenty to keep her safe and happy. From a place of shame and disconnection, it would be very difficult for me to assess my behaviors, much less attempt to change them. I often require my students to submit a strengths assessment at the beginning of the semester. I ask them to list 10 to 15 personal strengths. Be assured, I don't accept anything like, I'm a people person, or I play well with others. They hate doing this exercise, which is ironic considering that this is something that social workers very often expect their clients to do. Not surprisingly, when I ask them to identify their limitations or opportunities for growth, they buzz right through it, and normally list far more than the 5 examples I ask for. It's human nature. We focus on our shortcomings, and ignore and take our strengths for granted. It is critical that we catch ourselves doing things well. If we can acknowledge our strengths, they become tools that can help us meet our goals. For example, Natalie, a research participant, told me, I can talk about my faith because I don't think there is one right answer. I'm not worried about sounding stupid. I don't care if people judge me. I just care about being honest. I freeze when people talk about politics or public issues. I feel so ashamed that I don't know more or I don't have the right information. If Natalie wants to work on her authenticity around speaking out on political or social issues, it would be very useful for her to assess the strengths that allow her to be authentic in her discussions about faith. What is she doing that makes her feel authentic? What tools is she using to be genuine in her discussions? Why is she comfortable talking about faith and not politics? Based on my discussion with Natalie, I think it would be helpful for her to reframe her ideas about political and social issues having only one right answer. She might also think about changing her goal from being right, having the right information and knowing more, to being honest about her thoughts. She seems to do that really well. Lastly, we can more readily identify our strengths and increase our resilience by adapting the reality check questions to examine the expectations that attempt to govern how we articulate and act on our beliefs and values. How realistic are these expectations? Can I be all these things all of the time? Do I want to be? Can all of these characteristics exist in one authentic person? Does meeting the expectations make me more or less authentic? Am I describing my authentic self, or who others want me to be? When I asked participants how they determined who belongs in their connection network and who belongs in their shame web, about 80% of the women said something along the lines of, "If I can always be myself with someone, they're in the connection network." I think the ability to be ourselves is both the heart of authenticity and the true benefit of building shame resilience. Shame resilience theory. The information in this book is based on the theory of shame resilience that emerged from my research. I really like the definition of theory found in the Fifth Discipline Field book, a wonderful book on building learning organizations. The authors define theory as a fundamental set of propositions about how the world works, which has been subjected to repeated tests, and in which we have gained some confidence. The English word theory comes from the Greek root word theoros, meaning spectator. This derives from the same root as the word theater. Human beings invent theories for the same basic reasons they invent theater, to bring out into a public space a play of ideas that might help us better understand our world. My theory on shame is called the Shame Resilience Theory. It offers a set of propositions about how shame affects women. If we look at the continuums as distinct pieces of a larger puzzle, we can see how the theory comes together. The major propositions that explain how shame works are: shame is best defined as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. Women often experience shame when they are entangled in a web of layered, conflicting, and competing social community expectations. Shame creates fear, blame, and disconnection. The opposite of experiencing shame is experiencing empathy. Empathy requires that we practice ordinary courage, compassion, and connection. We cannot become resistant to shame. However, we can develop shame resilience. Shame resilience is best conceptualized as a continuum, with shame anchoring one end and empathy anchoring the other end. Our level of shame resilience is determined by our combined ability to recognize shame and our specific triggers, our level of critical awareness, our willingness to reach out to others, and our ability to speak shame. In other words, our position on the shame resilience continuum is actually the sum of our positions on these other four continuums. We must assess our shame resilience independently for each shame category. A high level of shame resilience in one area does not guarantee high shame resilience for all areas. Women with higher levels of shame resilience recognize shame when they are experiencing it and recognize their shame triggers. Understanding our triggers allows us to better recognize shame and reach out for support. When we don't know our vulnerabilities, we rely on ineffective methods to protect ourselves from the pain caused by shame. I call these shame screens. Women who practice critical awareness have higher levels of shame resilience. Critical awareness helps us demystify, contextualize, and normalize our shame experiences. A lack of critical awareness can result in our reinforcing, individualizing, and pathologizing our shame experiences. Women who reach out to others who are experiencing shame have higher levels of shame resilience. Reaching out allows us to share our stories and create change. When we don't reach out to others, we often start separating and insulating ourselves from others. Women who speak shame have higher levels of shame resilience. Speaking shame gives us the tools we need to express how we feel and ask for what we need. When we don't speak shame, we often start to shut down or act out. 10. Creating a culture of connection. In April 2006, I attended an awards dinner hosted by the Feminist Majority Foundation. The celebration was in honor of four women who had won the prestigious Nobel Peace Prize: Shirin Ebadi, Iran, 2004; Rigoberto Menchú Tum, Guatemala, 1992; Betty Williams, Ireland, 1975; and Jody Williams, USA, 1997. At the end of the evening, women's rights activist Mavis Leno took the stage to close the event. She looked out at the enthusiastic audience and said, "We can all make a difference." I took a deep breath and waited to hear what would come next. Unless you want to sound like a bumper sticker, how can you inspire people to change the world in one or two sentences? How do you help people believe they really can make a difference without overwhelming them with responsibility or patronizing them with clichés? Most of us haven't dedicated our lives to world peace. We aren't convinced that we have what it takes to change the world. In fact, sometimes it takes every ounce of our energy just to unload the dishwasher. Well, I have to say that on this particular night, I was moved. Mavis Leno nailed it. She looked at the audience and simply said, "If you want to make a difference, the next time you see someone being cruel to another human being, take it personally. Take it personally because it is personal." It was the single most inspiring call to change I've heard. We all know how to take it personally. In fact, when we witness cruelty, it's human nature to take it personally. If we choose not to get involved or pretend it's not happening, we're going against the very sense of connection that makes us human. If we want to transform our culture of shame into a culture of connection, we need to take what we see, hear, witness, and do personally. Shaming is cruel. When our children are watching reality TV shows that rely on shame and degradation as entertainment, we turn them off and explain why. When someone uses hurtful and demeaning stereotypes, we find the courage to explain why we're not comfortable with the conversation. When someone shares her shaming experience with us, we make the choice to practice compassion. We work to hear what she is saying and to connect to what she is feeling. Taking it personally means changing the culture by owning our experiences and holding ourselves and others accountable. Too often when we experience shame, we stay quiet. If we do find the courage to tell our story, we are often told that we are too sensitive or that we are taking it too personally. I've never understood that. Should we be insensitive and detached? The culture of shame feeds on insensitivity and detachment. Caroline is a great example of the power of taking it personally. In the introduction, I shared this snippet of her story. "One day I was driving down the street in our neighborhood and I stopped next to a car full of young men at a light. They were looking over and smiling. I smiled back and even blushed a bit. Then out of nowhere, my 15-year-old daughter, who was sitting in the back seat with her best friend, snapped, 'Geez, Mom, stop looking at them. What do you think? They're flirting with you? Get real.' I could barely hold the tears back. How could I have been so stupid?" Caroline was in her early 50s when we first met in 2003. She told me this story in 2005, when I interviewed her for a second time. She explained that her handling of this shaming moment was a turning point for her. Here's Caroline's story of ordinary courage and resilience. "It's not this experience that changed the way I feel about myself. It was how I handled it with my daughter. Rather than yelling at her or sulking, I decided to use what I knew about shame resilience. I dropped the girls off, came home and called my neighbor. We've been friends for a long time. I told her what happened and how ashamed I was. I told her that I was ashamed for smiling at the young men, and I was ashamed of how my daughter treated me in front of her friend. When my friend asked me why I was ashamed for smiling at the men, I told her that I had actually thought for one split second that they were smiling at me. I explained that I forgot that I'm old, and that doesn't happen anymore. She understood my shame. She didn't try to make it better, she just listened. Finally, she said, "It hurts when they don't see us, the boys in the cars, our kids. They just stop seeing us." She understood. My husband picked up my daughter from her friend's house, and my other daughter from softball practice. When they got home, I was in my room. I came out right away and asked my daughter if I could talk to her. She responded by saying, "Oh, God, are you menopausal again?" The rest of the family laughed. This time, rather than laughing with them or pretending not to care, I said, "No, you really hurt my feelings today, and we need to talk about it." On that note, my husband and younger daughter flew out of the room. I sat down with my daughter and explained how ashamed I felt when she made that comment and why. I even explained how hard it was for me as a woman, not as a mother, but as a woman. I told her that I understood that it was very important for her to be cool and have her friends like her. However, it was unacceptable for her to be hurtful to others in order to make that happen. The entire time I was talking, she was making faces and rolling her eyes. I finally reached out and took both of her hands and said, "What you said made me feel very ashamed and hurt. I'm telling you this because I know you love me and our relationship is important. I'm also telling you this so you know that you should not let people shame you or put you down so they look cool or popular. I won't let you do that to me, and I hope you don't let anyone do that to you." As Caroline told me her story, I waited anxiously to hear about her daughter's heartfelt apology and the tender mother-daughter embrace. Of course, it never happened. Caroline said that her daughter responded with a resounding, "Oh my God, can I please go now?" Caroline told her daughter that she needed to apologize, and she did. Then she went to her room, shut the door, and turned on her radio. We will never know what impact this conversation had on Caroline's daughter. However, based on my professional and personal experience, I believe these conversations can be life-changing. Caroline took it personally, and if all parents lived by these beliefs and had talks like this with their children, we would start to see the culture change. If the children who heard these talks expected more from themselves and their friends, we'd see a cultural shift. It doesn't take momentous events, it takes critical mass. If enough of us make small changes in our lives, we will see big changes. To create real cultural change, I think it's equally important that we understand how men and children are affected by shame. I think it makes sense for shame resilience to start with women. We are often the primary caregivers of children, and women are more likely to be the psychological and cultural change agents for our families. Resilience can start with us, however, it can't stop with us. We need to understand how and why men struggle with shame and how they build resilience. We need to understand how we can support and connect with our partners, sons, fathers, brothers, friends, and colleagues. We also need to understand more about shame in children. For most of us, our experiences with parents and teachers shaped our current struggles with shame. In fact, 80% of the people I interviewed could remember a specific shaming incident in elementary school or junior high that changed how they felt about themselves as learners. In the following two sections, I'll share an overview of my new research on men and shame, and my study on how shame is in parenting and in classrooms. These are both works in progress, but what I've learned so far speaks to how inextricably connected we all are. Men and shame. My initial decision to study only women was based on the current academic literature on shame. Many researchers believe that men and women's experiences of shame are different. Because I wanted to conduct an in-depth study of resilience, I chose to look at women only. I was concerned that if I combined the data from men and women, I'd miss some of the important nuances of their experiences. I did actually interview some young men in the beginning of my study. I'll share that experience with you because it proved to be very profound. Several years ago, in the shame categories, appearance and body image, motherhood, family, parenting, money and work, mental and physical health, addiction, sex, aging, religion, being stereotyped and labeled, speaking out, and surviving trauma, first started emerging from the research. I interviewed groups of older teens to find out how the categories fit for this age group. My intention was to interview young women only. Well, as it turned out, the clinicians who ran the groups scheduled time for me to meet with several groups of young men. I had never worked with older teenage boys before, and I was a little nervous. I remember writing the categories on a chalkboard, sitting down, looking at this group of young men and thinking, they aren't going to say anything. I started with a question about appearance. Okay, guys, what about appearance? Are there expectations about how you're supposed to look? They looked at one another, and one young man said, yeah, miss, I gotta look like I can kick your ass. The rest of the boys laughed and agreed. I moved on. Okay, what about health? Again, they laughed. Another boy said, yeah, miss, it's the same thing. You can't be too sick to kick someone's ass. Many of these boys were already fathers, so I thought I'd move away from the easy ones to something more complex, like fatherhood. Okay, tell me about fatherhood. Again, they laughed, but a little less this time. One boy said, look, you talk about my baby or my baby's mother? I'm gonna kick your ass. Well, call me a researcher. But I was starting to see a theme. The more we talked, the more I realized that these young men meant business. It didn't matter what they did or what they looked like, as long as they maintained their image of being able to kick someone's ass. I wrote up my ass-kicking field notes and filed them away. It wasn't until I started interviewing men last year that I realized how honest, poignant, and truthful these young men had been. In their own language, they told me almost everything I needed to know. A stranger, a penis, and a feminist. In 2005, three separate incidents convinced me to commit more time to studying shame and men. A stranger, a penis, and a feminist. We'll start with the stranger. He was a tall, thin man who, I'd guess, was in his early 60s. He was attending one of my lectures with his wife. After the lecture, he followed his wife to the front of the room to talk to me. I spoke with her for a few minutes, and as she started to walk away, he turned to her and said, I'll be right there. Give me a minute. His wife looked concerned. I don't think she wanted him to stay and talk to me. She finally walked toward the back of the room, and he turned to face me. He said, I like what you have to say about shame. It's interesting. I thanked him and waited. I could tell there was more coming. He said, I'm curious. What about men and shame? What have you learned about us? I felt instant relief. This wasn't going to take long because I didn't know much. I explained, I haven't done many interviews with men, just women. He nodded and said, well, that's convenient. I was curious what he meant. I smiled and asked him, why convenient? He replied by asking me if I really wanted to know. I told him yes, and I meant it. His eyes welled up with tears. He said, we have shame, deep shame, but when we reach out and share our stories, we get the emotional shit beat out of us. I struggled to maintain my eye contact with him. I felt like crying. He continued, and it's not just by other guys. Of course, they beat it out of us, but so do the women. You say you want us to be vulnerable and real, but come on. You can't stand it. It makes you sick to see us like that. By this point, tears were streaming down my face. I had this very visceral reaction to what he was saying. He let out a long sigh, and as quickly as he had begun, he said, "That's all I wanted to say. Thanks for listening." Then he just walked away. I was still processing that conversation when a few days later I was lying on a table as a woman glided a little receiver back and forth over my big pregnant belly. She looked at Ellen and said, "What do you want, a brother or a sister?" Ellen shouted, "A brother! I want a brother!" The woman smiled and said, "It's your lucky day. Mommy is having a boy." I smiled at Ellen and put my hand on my stomach. "Are you sure?" I asked. She smiled. "I see the penis." I managed to smile again at Ellen as she jumped up and down. On the inside, I was screaming, "A boy, no, not a boy. They get the emotional shit beat out of them. How will I protect him? I don't know anything about the boy world." Fast forward to a few weeks after Charlie, my beautiful baby boy, was born. Charlie and I were having lunch with some of my favorite feminist friends when we started talking about the challenges of raising boys. As we were all doting on Charlie, my friend Debbie Okrina, a social worker and domestic violence activist, said, "You know, if we aren't helping boys and men, we're really not helping girls and women. We need to do more." Her statement led to a long and important conversation about gender and masculinity. Our conversation helped me put words to my strong belief that feminism is not just about equality for women, but also about the fight to liberate both men and women from our gender straitjackets. Until both men and women are allowed to be who we are rather than who we are supposed to be, it will be impossible to achieve freedom and equality. A stranger, a penis, and a feminist. It might sound like the start to a bad joke, but these three events changed my mind and my life. The next week, I started reading the literature and lining up interviews. It was overwhelming. At some level, I think my resistance was based on an intuitive sense that I would be stumbling into a new and strange world. A world of hurt. Describing shame. Before I even started interviewing, I had presented my theory to thousands of helping professionals and laypeople. Over the years, I've emailed and spoke with many men about my work, some of them strangers, others friends and colleagues. Almost all of them would say something like, "Your work fits for us, but there's something different about our experiences. Our world is different. The expectations are different." As a researcher, the big question for me was this: does shame resilience theory fit for men? If I interviewed men about their shame experiences and the various strategies they use to combat shame, would I find that, like women, they experience fear, blame, and disconnection when they are in shame? Would they move out of shame using the same elements of shame resilience? Or because the expectations that drive shame for both men and women are very gender-specific, would I need to develop an entirely new theory, one especially for men? The conclusion I've drawn from my research is this. When we experience shame, we respond to it with our entire being. It affects the way we feel, think, and act, and often we have a strong physical response to shame. In other words, shame is a core emotion. It strikes us at our center and radiates through every part of us. While there are certainly significant differences between men and women's experiences, we are very much the same at our core. As I wrote in the introduction, we are wired for connection. All of us, men and women alike, have the basic need to feel accepted and to believe that we belong and are valued. The definition that I developed from my interviews with women fits equally well with men. Just like us, they experience shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing they are flawed and therefore unworthy of acceptance and belonging. And, just as women described it, shame leaves men with overwhelming feelings of fear, blame, and disconnection. In fact, if you look at the shame resilience model, it all fits. After interviewing 51 men, I feel confident that their experiences of shame and the strategies they use to build shame resilience are, again, at the core, the same basic process that women experience. But there are tremendous differences when it comes to the social community expectations that drive shame and the messages that reinforce those expectations. For men, the expectations and messages center around masculinity and what it means to be a man. In other words, the how we experience shame might be the same, but the why we experience shame is very different. In Chapter 2, I introduced the shame web and how women most often experience shame as a web of layered, conflicting, and competing social community expectations that dictate who we should be, what we should be, and how we should be. When I spoke with men, I didn't hear about layered, conflicting, and competing social community expectations. The expectation, clear and simple: do not let people see anything that can be perceived as weakness. Who should men be? Anyone, as long as you're not perceived as weak. What should men be? Anything, as long as you're not perceived as weak. How should men be? Any way, as long as you're not perceived as weak. And to better understand what constitutes weakness, we can start by looking at the definitions of shame I heard from some of the men I interviewed. Shame is failure, at work, on the football field, in your marriage, in bed, with money, with your children. It doesn't matter. Shame is failure. Shame is being wrong. Not doing it wrong, but being wrong. Shame is a sense of being defective. Shame happens when people think you're soft. It's degrading and shaming to be seen as anything but tough. Revealing any weakness is shaming. Basically, shame is weakness. Showing fear is shameful. You can't show fear. You can't be afraid, no matter what. Shame is being seen as the guy you can shove up against the lockers. Our worst fear is being criticized or ridiculed. Either one of those is extremely shaming. It is a major oversimplification, but if you think back to my story about the teenage boys and their kick-your-ass approach to avoiding shame, they seem to be right on target. Men are under tremendous pressure to appear tough, strong, stoic, powerful, successful, fearless, in control, and able. These are the social community expectations that form their valued identities. While women have the impossible task of balancing, negotiating, and traversing expectations that are unattainable and often conflicting, men are suffocating under the tremendous pressure of always appearing strong, fearless, and powerful, which is equally unattainable. The metaphor I use to explain the phenomenon for women is the shame web. For men, I see something different. As men described their shame experiences to me, I started seeing a very small box, a box that is hammered closed by expectations of always appearing tough, strong, powerful, successful, fearless, in control, and capable. As the mother of a 1-year-old son, I've learned and already witnessed that we place men in these small, cramped boxes very early, basically at birth. We keep them trapped by rewarding, reinforcing, and punishing. We reward their willingness to stay in the box by celebrating their toughness, and reinforce and punish by labeling any demonstration of vulnerability or emotion, especially fear, grief, and sadness, as weakness. At first, when boys are little, they have some wiggle room in the box. Parents, peers, and our society at large are more willing to tolerate vulnerability and emotion. However, as boys grow older and bigger, there is less room in the box. We quash their efforts to escape by shaming boys and men for being weak, soft, fearful, inadequate, powerless, and incapable. And based on the participants' stories, it seems that fathers and male peers can be especially wounding to boys and men who stray from the norms of masculinity. Certainly, women, mothers, sisters, partners, girlfriends, daughters also shame men about their masculinity and power. However, across the interviews, they seem to have more of a reinforcing role, whereas men, especially fathers, brothers, peers, and coaches, tend to do more punishing. Paul's story is a powerful example of how shame and the fear of shame are used to reward, reinforce, and punish men. Both Paul and his younger brother grew up playing competitive baseball. They even played in college. Paul said that he remembers his father saying things like, "Don't be a pussy and stay tough," as early as first or second grade. Paul described his life growing up as equal parts stressful and awesome. The stress was due to the constant pressure to perform and succeed. But he also said, "I was always very popular and had lots of hot girlfriends." He also explained that he received many special allowances from teachers and school administrators due to his athletic abilities and popularity. After college, Paul went to work for a dot-com owned by a friend and married Meg, a young woman he had dated in college. About 1 year into their marriage, Paul's company folded. He had received such an inflated salary at the dot-com that he struggled to find a comparable salary right away. After 2 months, he told Meg that he was going to take a sales job and that his salary would be about half of what it had been. He suggested to her that they sell their cars and buy less expensive cars and cut down on other shopping expenses. He told me, Meg lost it. She said that it was totally unfair for her to have to give up her lifestyle because I couldn't find a job. She went on and on until she finally asked, "Aren't you embarrassed that you can't support me?" Paul said he was devastated. He felt tremendous shame about not being able to make enough money, and he was deeply hurt by Meg's lack of concern for him. Unsure what to do, he called his father for advice. In the middle of the story, Paul started to cry a bit. He told me that it was the first time he ever remembered crying in front of his father. After listening to the story, Paul's father told him that he needed to set Meg straight and get in their face at work about a better salary. When Paul asked what that meant, his father said, "Don't be so weak. You don't need to put up with that shit. Meg doesn't want to be married to someone who lets her talk that way. You're a bigger loser for letting her get away with that. And those guys at work want someone who has the balls to demand a better salary. What's wrong with you?" Paul described the 2 days in which these conversations with his wife and father took place as the beginning of the end. He went into what he called a dark spot. He started hanging out with his friends and drinking almost every night. Meg and Paul got divorced, and Paul's parents are now separated after 25 years of marriage. The good news is that at the time of our interview, Paul's mother and brother had started visiting Paul more often, and the three of them are trying to build a new, stronger relationship. He also told me that he recognized that the drinking was getting out of hand and had decided to slow down. In Paul's story, we can see how his masculinity, his athleticism, winning, and toughness was rewarded. He was popular. He dated many attractive young women. He was given special privileges at school, and he was offered an extremely high-paying job by a former teammate. We can also see how Meg reinforced the social community expectations of men as providers by ridiculing him about his lower salary and his career struggles. Lastly, Paul's father's behavior is a clear example of how name-calling and shaming is often used to punish men when they don't meet the social community expectations set before them. I plan to continue interviewing men, possibly with the help of a male researcher. I think there are important conversations about shame and vulnerability that need to happen between men and women. Men are certainly socialized to hide their vulnerabilities and fears, but it seems that women play an important role in that socialization. One man told me, "Women would rather see us die on top of that white horse than to be forced to watch us fall off it." I think this captures a lot of what I heard in the interviews with both men and women. However, I don't think it's what we really want. When men and women shame each other and reinforce unattainable gender expectations, we kill intimacy. If we can't be authentic, we can't connect in a meaningful way. Our relationships move from compassion and connection to fear, blame, and disconnection. I don't think any of us want this for ourselves or for our children. Shame, parenting, and education. Shame starts at home, Fortunately, so does shame resilience. As parents, we have the opportunity to raise children who are courageous, compassionate, and connected. We can choose to learn the tools we need to parent without using shame. We can even teach our children empathy skills. But as you might guess, before we can teach or model these skills, we must understand the role shame plays in our own lives and practice resilience in our relationships. Parenting is a shame minefield. Not only do we hang our self-worth on how we are perceived as parents, but we hang a big part of it on how our children are perceived. We have to contend with our list of unwanted identities and an entirely new list for our children. We don't want to be perceived as bad parents, and we don't want our children to be perceived as bad kids. Developing shame resilience is twice as difficult, but well worth the reward. Once we begin practicing courage, compassion, and connection as parents, we can start to help our children navigate their increasingly complex worlds. We might not be able to control what happens at our children's schools or in their peer groups, but when we teach them shame resilience, we help them recognize shame, move through it constructively, and grow from their experiences. It's important to understand that parents also have the power to teach and model fear, blame, and disconnection. Sometimes our children learn fear, blame, and disconnection because we use shame to parent them. Rather than focusing on their behaviors, we attack who they are or belittle them. We threaten them with disconnection or ridicule them in front of others. Sometimes, even if parents aren't shaming their children, the children still experience fear, blame, and disconnection simply because we haven't taught them the skills of shame resilience. So even if we're not shaming them, we've left them very vulnerable to shame from teachers, coaches, and peers. I'm not singling out teachers and coaches. Like the rest of us, most are doing the best they can with the information they have. I'm a teacher, and I'm proud to say that both of my sisters are elementary school teachers. Teachers and coaches are also negotiating the culture of shame in their own professions. At the same time, education spending is being cut, and classrooms are overcrowded. Teachers are under tremendous pressure to raise standardized test scores. Coaches who push too hard are criticized, and parents who want their kids to be winners harass coaches who emphasize fun and health over winning. As I continue to interview parents, teachers, coaches, and child development experts, I hope to learn more about what we can do to change our own parenting approaches and build a stronger culture of connection for our children. I think it's important that this book ends where it began, with connection. We are wired for connection. It's in our biology. As infants, our need for connection is about survival. As we grow older, connection means thriving, emotionally, physically, spiritually, and intellectually. Connection is critical because we all have the basic need to feel accepted and to believe that we belong and are valued for who we are. Although it might seem overly optimistic that we can create a culture of connection simply by making different choices, I think it is possible. Change doesn't require heroics. Change begins when we practice ordinary courage.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of I Thought It Was Just Me, But It Isn't. Telling the Truth About Perfectionism, Inadequacy, and Power. Written by Brené Brown. Narrated by Lorne Fortgang. Executive Producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2007 by Brené Brown. Production copyright 2010 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.